The Night Stalker's reign of terror would eventually come to an end, but the strangeness of his character was still to be revealed. I'm Felicia Huffman, and this is Macabre at Midnight. We're back.
Hello.
My mom's here with us for the conclusion of the Night Stalker saga, I guess. It's not really a saga, it's only two episodes. So how have you been?
I've been good. How have you?
Good.
Yeah.
Did the cat hurt your arm?
Shaking her did.
Last time, we went over all of his killings.
Uh-huh.
Not all of his crimes, just the killings.
Right.
So let's find out how they put a stop to his antics. On August 24th, 1985, after Ramirez's encounter with Inez Erickson, Erickson provided the police with a detailed description of the assailant. Police also got a cast of Ramirez's footprint from the Romero house. They found the stolen car on August 28th in Wilshire Center, and police were able to get a single fingerprint from the rearview mirror despite the fact that Ramirez did his best to wipe the car clean. They were able to positively identify the print as Ramirez's, who had been described as a 25-year-old drifter from Texas who had a long rap sheet. On August 29th, law enforcement officials released Ramirez's mugshot from his 1984 arrest, and the Night Stalker was finally given a face. At the press conference, they said, quote, "We know who you are now, and soon everyone else will. There will be no place you can hide," end quote. With that information, the police started to receive numerous calls from people having spotted the Night Stalker. Unaware that he was now all over the news, he took a bus on August 30th to visit his brother in Tucson. When he wasn't able to meet up with his brother, he returned to Los Angeles, which would be a big mistake. He walked past a few officers who were staking out a bus terminal in the hopes of catching him in East Los Angeles on August 31st and walked into a liquor store. There was a group of elderly Mexican women who were calling him El Matador, meaning the killer. That's when shoppers at a liquor store reported that Ramirez picked up a newspaper, looked at his photo on the cover, and ran. He ran across the Santa Ana freeway and tried to carjack a woman, but bystanders chased him away. Police were alerted, and they started chasing him in their vehicles and with helicopters. He then ran off to another vehicle where the driver, Angie De La Torre, fought back. He punched the woman in the stomach and got the keys to her car. Her 85-year-old neighbor ran out, and Ramirez threatened to shoot him if he came closer. However, Jose didn't see a gun, so he opened the door and pulled him out. Onlookers joined in. Even De La Torre's husband got involved by hitting him in the head with barbecue utensils. But Ramirez got away from them. He raced down the street as the mob of angry citizens chased after him. At some point, somebody struck Ramirez in the head with a metal bar, causing him to fall. The crowd began to beat Ramirez. They continued to beat him until the police were able to pull him from their grasps. Bleeding and bruised, Ramirez was placed in handcuffs and put into a police car, ending his reign of terror. Now it's time to try him for his crimes. Something I did not go over in the first episode was that Ramirez didn't just kill and rape adults. Early on in his crimes, there were a series of young children who were taken from their beds, assaulted, and then abandoned. One of the 6-year-old survivors was instrumental in identifying Ramirez. However, investigators chose to drop these charges to spare the children any more trauma. But that same 6-year-old was ready to help if they needed her. The jury selection for his trial started on July 22, 1988. As you can imagine, finding jurors for this case was not easy given the nature of the crimes. At his first court appearance, Ramirez had drawn a pentagram on his hand, raised that hand, and said, "Hail Satan." On August 3rd, jail employees reportedly overheard Ramirez planning to shoot the prosecutor with the gun which he was going to smuggle into the courtroom. That's when they installed a metal detector, and intensive searches were conducted on everybody who entered. On August 14th, the trial was delayed, but when Phyllis Singletary, a juror, did not show up. Later on that day, she was found shot to death in her apartment.
Uh-oh.
The rest of the jury was terrified, wondering if Ramirez had directed the attack on her and if he would get to the rest of them. However, they figured out that Ramirez was not responsible. Her boyfriend had shot and killed her before committing suicide with the same weapon in the hotel. However, the alternate juror who replaced Singletary was too frightened to return to her home. Finally, on September 20th, 1989, Ramirez was convicted on 13 counts of murder, 5 attempted murders, 11 sexual assaults, and 14 burglaries. During the penalty phase, they sentenced him to death in the gas chamber. He then made a statement to reporters saying, quote, "Big deal. Death always went with this territory. See you in Disneyland," end quote. His trial costed $1.8 million, which would be $3.71 million today, which was the most expensive case in California history until O.J. Simpson's murder case. By the time Ramirez's trial started, he had fans who would send him letters and pay him visits. Starting in 1985, Doreen Leoy wrote him nearly 75 letters during his incarceration. In 1988, he proposed to her, and they got married at San Quentin on October 3, 1996. For several years before his death, Leoy said she would commit suicide if he was executed. However, Leoy left Ramirez in 2009 after they confirmed he had killed 9-year-old Mei Ling. At the time of his death, he was engaged to another woman, 23-year-old writer Christine Lee. Due to California's lengthy appeal process, his first round of appeals didn't end until August 7, 2006. They all proved to be unsuccessful, though, and the California Supreme Court upheld his conviction and death sentence. A month later, they denied his request for a rehearing. There were additional appeals pending when he died. The subject of his mental health has always been a big topic because what could cause somebody to commit criminal acts so heinous? Something had to be wrong. Michael H. Stone, a psychiatrist, said that Ramirez was made a psychopath as opposed to being born a psychopath. This means that something happened to him during his life that caused him to develop his psychopathic ways. He said that Ramirez's schizoid personality disorder contributed to his indifference to the suffering of his victims and left him untreatable. Stone also said that the fact that Ramirez was knocked unconscious and almost died on multiple occasions before he was 6 resulted in the development of hypersexuality, temporal lobe epilepsy, and aggressivity. Ramirez would never have to face the gas chamber. On June 7, 2013, he died of complications secondary to B-cell lymphoma at Marin General Hospital. His chronic substance abuse had also adversely affected his health, and he suffered from chronic hepatitis C. He was 53 and had served on death row for over 23 years. Some have estimated that he would have likely been in his early 70s before he ever had his execution carried out. Before we wrap up the Night Stalker, here are a few other interesting facts. When he would murder, he would have a snack. Frank Salerno, one of the detectives on the case, said that he got comfortable in his killings to the point that he would have a snack afterwards. With the killing in San Francisco, the police said that after he killed Pan and raped his wife, he ate everything in their fridge and threw it up on their kitchen floor, and then masturbated on the living room floor.
Oh, that's disgusting.
Before he was actually apprehended, there were a few times when investigators just missed him. One time, he attempted to kidnap somebody but failed. While he was driving away, he committed a traffic violation and a cop saw him. As he was being pulled over, Ramirez heard a broadcast of his kidnapping attempt on the cop's radio, so he got out, drew a pentagram on the hood of the stolen car, and ran. We all know that he had really bad teeth, and in that stolen car, they discovered a business card for a dentist's office. When they looked through the dentist's records, they found a man by the name of Richard Mena, who had been in for x-rays, which showed he had an infected tooth. They knew he would be back. Two officers were stationed at the office, but as time went by without sign of Ramirez, the dentist office suggested that they install an alarm and alert the police should Ramirez show back up, which they did. But when Ramirez did come in, the alarm malfunctioned. His shoes were a big part of the investigation, which was why the investigators had never released that information. They knew Ramirez was watching the news, and if he found out they knew what shoes he wore, he would ditch them. However, Dianne Feinstein, the mayor of San Francisco at the time, released all of the investigative information they had about him after he murdered Peter Pan. They were never able to recover those shoes. I want to end the story on this note. His parents made this comment when he died in 2013. Quote, "We are mourning the loss of our son and brother, Richard Ramirez. The world judged him, whether fairly or unfairly, it no longer matters. He is now before the true judge, the judge that sees and knows all things. We ask that you respect our sorrow and grief." End quote. I'm sure most of his family was hurting, but what irks me the most was that his father acted like he was the world's greatest dad after his son got arrested. He paid for the best attorney and all that. However, in my opinion, his father is the main person to blame for the way Richard turned out. If his father hadn't beat him and left him no one to turn to for a good role model other than his cousin, all of those people may not have been murdered. So why, in the end, act like he actually cared about his son? Your thoughts?
To make him look better in the eyes of the public. That's what narcissists do.
I don't know that they shared information about what his childhood was like during the trial or anything like that. And even in the Netflix special on The Night Stalker, they barely mentioned in passing that his dad wasn't the best and that he suffered from seizures and stuff like that. They just glazed over it. And it kind of bugs me. They want to ignore the mental health aspect that plays a role in how a majority of these serial killers, why they ended up doing what they did. They just want to be like he was a bad person and he got what he deserved. But, like, you know, a lot of this could be prevented.
Yeah. Yeah, it really could. It's kind of like kids getting shoved through the educational system. Yep. Don't want to fool with. I don't think it happens as much now as it used to, but just send them on. Back in my day, the parents had the final say-so as to whether or not a child got left or got held back. And if parents didn't want the child held back, they got sent on to the next grade, where they just kept getting further and further and further behind.
Yep. I think that's stupid.
It is.
Because parents, unless it's a parent that actually cares and is involved in their child's life, they're not going to know how smart their child is or how well they're doing. Well, I mean, I know report cards are sent in, so they should know by that, but.
And I think even if they, because there's a few friends of mine that just got sent on through the system because, well, one, it would have embarrassed the parent if their child was left behind that made them look like a bad parent because their child was stupid, was what I heard.
Well,
and it's not that the child was stupid. The child was a little bit slower than the rest of us, and repeating that grade could have helped them. They would never catch back up with us. I get that point. But get out of your own little head and your own little world.
Yeah.
And think about your child and what would be best for that child.
And quit thinking of it in terms of smart and dumb. Because nobody's dumb per se. They might just learn slower or understand things differently mm-hmm. than other people. But that's how we've been conditioned to do stuff. And schools don't, they're not set up to teach kids the way they learn best. They're just set up like kind of a military type thing. You just have to go in and do it, no questions asked, in this certain way. And even when you have teachers who try to work with the students, some of the parents will find out about the fun stuff or interesting stuff they do, and then they get upset because it doesn't seem normal.
Yeah. Yeah, it's always irked me with, like his dad did, that knowing they were not in the child's life, knowing that...
Or at least not the way they should have been.
Right. And knowing how they treated that child, it's... I don't know. I lost my train of thought. I don't know. It bugs me that the audacity of some, knowing how they truly are, but yet in the eyes of everybody else, oh, they're this perfect parent, this perfect person, and there's no such thing as a perfect parent or a perfect person. Sorry of you out there who think you are, you're probably not.
Nobody could be perfect. Perfection doesn't exist.
No.
You
can be as good as you can be.
Yeah.
But there is no perfect.
I mean, yeah, do the best you can. But with that said, there's some out there who think they're doing the best they can, and they're really just doing the bare minimum.
Yeah.
Kind of like his parents. And, I mean, not to sound like I'm taking up for his father, because I'm not. I don't like the man, simply because of the way he did at the end. But I don't know that he would, I would go so far to say that he was like a narcissistic person, and that person that made everybody believe that his family was perfect when they weren't. I don't think he gave a crap when, like, his kids were growing up. Everybody pretty much knew the Ramirez's weren't, they didn't get along that well, especially with Richard and his father. I don't think that was a hidden fact. Maybe in the end, maybe the dad felt guilty and that's why he tried to help him out. I don't know. Or maybe he was just trying to do it to make himself feel better. I guess that's the same thing. But it wouldn't have done any good if his dad tried to probably apologize to Richard. Richard at that point wouldn't have cared.
Yeah.
But I'm honestly amazed he didn't go after his parents and his killings.
Yeah.
He just stayed in Los Angeles and then went to San Francisco for that one killing. But yeah, when I was watching the Netflix special, they glazed over his upbringing enough to make it clear that his dad played a big role in screwing him up mentally. And then at the end, once Richard gets arrested, they're like, the Ramirez is paid for the best lawyer. And I'm like, okay, first off, where is this money coming from the Ramirez's? At what point did he start making money? Because from what I got is they were kind of poor. And then all of a sudden their son gets arrested and they want to send him the best lawyer. And that lawyer, you could see it on his face, did not want to be there.
Oh, yeah.
And that's my thing, is when I was younger, I thought about being a lawyer, but I'm like, how do I choose which side? Because if I'm a prosecutor, there's a chance I could put an innocent person in jail.
Mm-hmm.
And as an adult, I'm glad I never decided to do that. It's because true crime shows tick me off, because the prosecutors, the DAs and stuff like that, they just ignore the fact that the person could actually be innocent. And they're like, nah, I don't care how many times he says he's innocent, he's guilty, because I have one piece of evidence that makes me think so, even though everything else tells me otherwise. But I ignore that stuff.
Yeah.
But then how do you also be a defending attorney when there's a chance that they're guilty of horrible crimes like this, and yet you're still trying to get them off? I mean, I guess if it's one of those things, you know they're guilty and you're just trying to get them a lesser sentence, that's a bit different. They're still going to pay for their crimes, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, because I don't know that I would have been like, you can pay me all you want, but I ain't defending him.
Mm-hmm.
Like, have you seen what he's done?
Exactly. And then use the defense attorneys, and that's where they have to get creative, so to speak, and do the, well, could he have been insane?
Well, he was insane, but he knew what he was doing.
Yeah, yeah. And there's a difference there. There's that fine line.
And that's what's always confused me when they use the insanity defense. Because I've read other ones where they're like, yeah, he is insane, but he's fit to stand trial. That's where I'm like, where is that line? How do you decide that he's not fit to stand trial? What type of insanity would make him where he doesn't even understand what's going on?
Yeah, well, I think that's where they use that term, mental competence.
Yeah.
They do some type of testing And I guess if they pass that test, that shows, well, they have all their mental faculties working, so they know what's going on. They know what they did. So let's try them for it. And then you've got those that have probably been shoved under and through the thing, whatever, where they weren't mentally able to stand trial, but
the DA did some shady work.
And they got them convicted anyways. And it's just like, I don't, in where we're at, where we live, there's two people that have been arrested for murder. One is a woman who stabbed her 5-year-old daughter to death. She just got charged for
second degree
involuntary manslaughter or something like that. And then there is a, I can't remember how old. I want to say he's between 12 and 16. I'm not exactly how old he is. But he was arrested on first-degree murder charges for killing his dad in self-defense. So you tell me how that's different.
And that's what bugs me, is people who kill in self-defense still have to prove in a court of law that it was self-defense and that they don't deserve to go to jail. And yet people tell you, oh, well, if it's in self-defense, it's not. But it is a big deal because people won't believe you.
Mm-hmm.
You get arrested for murder, plain and simple. It doesn't matter if it was in self-defense. And then it's up to you and your defense attorney to prove that it was in self-defense. And that DA or whoever is going to try to drag you under the bus, get as many people to badmouth you as they can to try to make it seem like you were the bad person and not that somebody was beating the crap out of you and that was the right. only thing you could do to defend yourself.
I mean, I don't understand how. I know it's in two different counties, but I don't understand how this underage teen or child gets charged with first degree murder when it was pretty sure no way to deny it was self defense, and how a 50-year-old woman can stab an innocent child to death and her just get charged with second degree murder. What's the difference? Why? I mean, I'm sure the 5-year-old didn't attack her. I don't understand.
Yeah, I don't understand how they choose to charge people. And I know some of the, when they're choosing what to charge a person with, they try to, I guess, get the highest thing they can that they know that they can prove beyond a shadow of a doubt.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, that with the child, and that the child thing goes back to, it helped remind me of what I was trying to say earlier about the Night Stalker, with the children he kidnapped and stuff. And most people probably, because I didn't know, he kidnapped and assaulted children and then abandoned them and everything in parks and stuff. He didn't kill them.
He just beat them up?
No, he sexually assaulted them.
Sexual assault, okay.
I'm pretty sure he only kidnapped females. I don't know. There might have been male children that he kidnapped. But I didn't realize he did that because of what I had read online and stuff. It didn't mention that. It was with the Netflix series that I learned about it. And they actually talked to the 6-year-old I mentioned in this, as she, her age now, as an adult. And she remembers it. She said that she was sleeping in bed and he must come in through her window and kind of woke her up. But he did it in such a way that she thought he was a family member. So mm-hmm. she went willingly with him until they were in the car and she realized she didn't know who he was. And I think he kept her for several days.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't remember where they were. He dropped her off at and everything, but she got returned to her family. But, and I don't remember how many children he did that to. But
did all the children survive?
Or? Except for that 9-year-old Mei Ling that they just proved that he killed back in 2009.
Okay.
But they of course, they were talking with the two detectives that were spearheading the case. I don't remember the other one's name. I just remember Frank's name. But both of the detectives, and I believe the DA was talking to this 6-year-old, and she was, I guess, being strong. And she, because she was telling them again what he did and what happened, and she said she was willing to do whatever it took to help convict him. And I don't remember which one got up first, but one of them excused himself to go to the kitchen because he was starting to cry.
Oh.
And I think he said like 5 minutes or so later, the other two was in the kitchen too, trying to compose themselves. And that's when they spoke, and they're like, let's just drop these charges. He's going to spend the rest of his life in jail with what we've got on him. Anyways, there's no sense in pulling these kids into this and having to make them go through that trial and to see him again and relive everything they've already experienced.
You know, it would have been, even though they dropped those charges, it would have been good if they could have, like, either videotaped or just tape recorded her telling her story and then playing it at the trial just to see what would have happened. I mean, it's, was she still 6 at the time that she was doing that, or was she a little bit older?
She might have been 7, or, well, she probably wouldn't have been 8, because it only happened over about a year and a half time.
Okay.
So she was either still 6 or 7. She was still really young.
And it's, I mean, it's good that she was able and is still able to talk and process it. Because that keeps it from eating away,
yeah,
so to speak, at her. And it's, I have to commend the parents, too, for allowing her to do that. A lot of parents would have just been like, no, you're not getting involved. You've been through enough. You know, I'm glad they allowed her to come forward and do that.
Yeah, because, you know, as, and I mean, I don't know, I'm not a psychologist, but I feel with what I've read, parents who want to just, like, this horrible thing happens to their kids, and whether they believe their child or not, and I hope they do, them trying to just shove it under the rug, no, you're not going to talk to her, and trying to, I guess, pretend like it never happened, I feel is worse on the child psychologically than letting them speak up and speak out about what happened to them, to the cops, or whoever it needs to be told to. That way they know it did happen, and they don't start second-guessing themselves, mm-hmm, and then able to process it.
I think it also helps them to feel valued,
yeah,
as a person.
Yeah.
I mean, it would me.
Yeah. Because you got to think, even if the parent means it to try to help their child to not have to relive the trauma, when they hear their parents say no, you're not talking to them about this, that, and other, the child, and they're in the child's mind, they're probably thinking, well, did it happen? Did, mm-hmm, I make it up? Is that why mom and dad doesn't want me to tell it? Like, mm-hmm, they start second guessing because they don't understand why that, yeah, their parents are just trying to protect them. But yeah. Any other thoughts?
I think I've spoken all I need to speak. There's nothing else popping up in my mind.
Well, the only thing that's still in my head is I just can't get over his dad.
Yeah, well.
Like, I don't want to lump, like I said at the end of it, I'm not lumping his whole family into it, because they were just as much a victim to their father's antics as Richard was. They just, fortunately, wasn't as affected negatively as Richard was. But that's just a big pet peeve to me when a person has hurt another person, and either physically or mentally, whatever, and then that person gets into trouble or has a rough spot or something happens to them, and then that the person that's hurt them is speaking all these good things or acting like this great person, and you're sitting there going, but yep, that's not who you didn't give a crap about them when they were alive. Why now?
Exactly. I think it just goes to the fact that they're trying to, quote, save face. Trying to make themselves look better. I mean, I don't know. Maybe there was some point in his life where he did realize how he had treated him, and that was the only way he knew to make up for it. I don't know.
I mean, yeah, that's a possibility.
But to me, too little, too late.
And we also don't know if his parents did reach out to him while he was in prison and try to patch things up or apologize. I mean, that's a possibility. And you can't expect to find every little piece of information online about a person. But, yeah. But, anywho, I guess that's it for tonight's episode. Check us out on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter. Stay spooky, everybody, and see you next time.